Welcome to Wellness Radio with Dr. Jeanette Gallagher as your host. Her show discusses topics of health, wellness, and spirituality and is about discovering your place in this great universe from your cells to the cosmos. Along with her guest, in casual conversation, she strives to ask the difficult questions that may be holding you back from a vibrant life and shares new ideas that may inspire you to make a change in your life that you only can see in your dreams. And now, here is Dr. Jeanette Gallagher.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Wellness Radio. This is Dr. Jeanette Gallagher, and it's a pleasure to have you with us here today. Today, we are going to talk about a topic which so many people seem to be struggling with these days, and I think it's only going to grow as other people start to say, you know, my parents are not well, maybe I should pay attention. My parents need a little bit of help, maybe I should move home. My parents are just not looking right, what's going on? Or even a family member. You know, I have said many times on this radio show, I grew up in the 50s, and I remember, you know, everybody lived within a two-mile block. The women and their kids walked from house to house. They would sit down at the table. The kids would play outside, and they would be able to talk about their lives, how things were going, how things weren't going, how they could help each other, and really a lot of their struggles. They spoke about it. And then I always say on the show, the worst thing that ever came about was that darn airplane, because that took people away from our communities and transplanted them to other places. And then what happened is the family stretched. But now we have the internet and texting, and everybody says everything's cool. Well, I don't know about that. But we'll talk about today how the human touch, human being able to take care of another person, and a lot of the struggles, or even the emotions, the frustrations, the love, the spirituality, and even still the humanity of each other in the process of caregiving. Today my guest is Elaine Sanchez. She is an author and co-founder of caregiverhelp.com, and her book we'll talk about today is Letters from Madeline, Chronicles of a Caregiver. It was letters that her mother had written and that she put into a book to be able to share with us her mother's passage as she cared for her husband. Elaine, thank you so much for joining us today. It's a pleasure
thank
to have you
with
us.
Thank you, Dr. Jeanette. It's just an honor to be with you, and I really appreciate the work you're doing and the opportunity to speak with you and your audience today. Thank you.
You know, Elaine, I think it is a interesting journey these days when we see everything's going on and we say, how does that fit in, you know? We look at our lives, you know, the first thing we do is we can't wait to get a job and have kids and a great success in a career. And then all of a sudden something comes along, you know, and it's illness or it's something happens to a family member. And we say, what do we do now? And I think that's where the word caregiver comes into play so many times, yes?
Oh, boy, isn't that the truth? Yes, you think you're getting along, you're managing your life as well as you can, and then you get a telephone call. And my call came on October 30th, 1993. I picked it up, and my mother said, your father's had a stroke. And this was his worst fear. So I was immediately upset and concerned, and I asked my mother, how bad is it? And she said, it's really bad. You know, the right side of his face is all lopsided and droopy. He can't talk. He's having trouble walking. He's completely lost the use of his right hand. And at that moment, everything changes. Everything that she thought was going to be in her future was different. And all of a sudden, I was a long-distance caregiver. And I think this happens to a lot of people. There are currently over 43 million family members who are caring, who are providing unpaid care for a loved one. And the typical caregiver is actually 49 years old and is usually a woman. But, of course, there are a lot of a tremendous number of older women and men who are caring for their spouses. And it's, I believe, Dr. Jeanette, that caregiving is one of the most difficult and generous acts of love that any of us will ever perform on behalf of another.
Well, I think with our parents living so much longer and some of relatives that we might also be caring for, that the caregiving role sometimes might even be when someone's in their 60s, caring for parents or relatives in their 80s, you know, and early 90s,
true.
You know? Yeah.
And
you wonder about it.
I have a 90-year-old aunt who lives in an active retirement community, and she had a friend who moved out of that into an assisted living facility, and her friend was like 75, and
right.
she was still, her parents were still alive, both parents
yeah.
were still alive and living in another facility, and I thought, that would be my worst nightmare. I can't imagine being,
right.
you know, elderly myself and ill and still being responsible for my parents.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think so, too. I've seen this many times, probably in about the past 5 years, is that it seems the elders, being that they're older and they're able to live longer, the younger people from 50 to 60, 65,
mm-hmm.
are not doing well health-wise. And I think they're doing, mm-hmm. Faring much worse than their elders. You know, and it's really been a tough challenge when you have a caregiver and a person you're taking care of that both have complications in the health realm, you
mm-hmm.
know, and or if we even look at the past 10 years, financially and everything
mm-hmm.
else in the world has just
mm-hmm.
been thrown into a loop.
Well, this is in your area, and I'm curious to know what you think. Why people in this baby boomer generation are not doing well? Do you think it's because of diet?
No, I think it's just, don't forget, we all came up in the years of vaccinations. That was first,
mm-hmm.
we were the first ones to get all those vaccinations.
Mm-hmm.
Antibiotics started in our decades. Also,
mm-hmm.
Fluoride was started to be put into water.
Mm-hmm.
Braces, I had braces, you know, everybody started getting all this, you see,
mm-hmm.
so we all got all of these influences, excuse me, in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, there was a whole lot of things that started to happen and be put out there, and we were still growing, and we were still young, whereas our parents may have experienced it also, but it didn't affect them as much, because they were already older, and it didn't really come into their realm.
Well,
you know, I can remember being a dental hygienist in the early 70s, and I mean the amount of fluoride that we put on people's teeth was incredible, and then the amount that was in the water and everything else, it was crazy. And, you know, that was all given to kids that were young then. And then we look at, you know, generations. We eventually have generations of what I call nicked DNA, you know, in other words, things just start getting knocked off. You know, there's going to be a cumulative effect. It's not that we're all this pristine, you know, healthy people, and we can just say, well, I'm going to do all these good things. I mean, I've said on the radio many times that, you know, hey, the guy has a bypass. He, you know, he's doing well. He went to therapy and everything. He's at the gym. He's on the treadmill, and there he goes, has a heart attack, and he's gone, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and even cardiac doctors die of heart disease, you know, or people who have doctors who have treat cancer patients may die of cancer. It's just the world that we live in, and I think mm-hmm. we all do the best we can, but you just start to see these trends where, you know, it seems to be the 50 to 65 that are not faring as well as even some of the elders now. I've
That's
seen
really
elders taking care of their 50, 60-year-olds.
Yes, yes, yes.
Yeah.
Whoever it is that is doing the
right.
caregiving is carrying a very heavy burden. That's for sure.
Yeah, and let's talk a little bit about what the word caregiver means to you, because I think everybody has a different version of that. They think,
mm-hmm.
What does a caregiver mean? I'm going to have to take care of their bills, or do I have to take care of their house, or do I take care of their health? What does that mean?
Well, that's an interesting question, and I think it's probably different for everyone. At the time my mother was caring for my dad, we didn't even have the term or use the term caregiver. She was just
right.
a woman who was taking care of her husband after he had a stroke. And I think that the term has come about really in like the last 10 years, that it has been identified as a role that people play, mm-hmm. you know, or take on. And I think that anyone who is feeling concerned about someone that they care about, whether it's a relative or a friend, and they feel a great deal of concern for them, if they feel like they need to check on them regularly, if they are involved in helping them manage their health care, their food, their, you know, just general living, then I think you are a form of a caregiver. In some cases, it's much more involved than others. A lot of people just spend a couple of hours a week, and some are living it 24/7. So I think if you are helping another person who is not fully capable of managing his or her own life, then you're a caregiver.
You know, I think if we look back at the decades, in the early 1900s, mid-1900s, a lot of people, if they got sick, they died quicker. They weren't, you know, they weren't kept by alive by chemo or radiation or all of these other interventions that would keep people hanging on. So I think when people got
That's
sick,
true.
You know, there wasn't this extended period of caretaking, as we would call it. They just did their job. They went out to work, and if they died, they died. That was the way it was.
That's right.
And, you know, I think this part of extending our lives, you know, longer and longer is really where the word caregiver potentially came into being, is because you really had to call it. It wasn't even a season of caregiving. It's called an eon of caregiving. You know,
mm-hmm.
It seems like it goes on forever.
Mm-hmm.
It takes over your life, and it alters and shapeshifts your life path, no matter who you are. And I also
mm-hmm.
think the word caregiver came into being, too, is when we wanted to be able to, quote, bill it. If we could bill it to insurance, or we could bill it to a nonprofit, or if we could bill it to whoever, to be able to say, I'm feeling this way because I'm a caregiver, or I'm feeling this way, I need help. Let me hire a caregiver, or let me bring in a caregiver. So I think the word kind of came about when people were saying there's something outside of there that has to come in to help. Do you know what I'm saying?
That's really interesting. I had never, ever considered that as being something that was billed. That's really interesting.
Well, you know, because the people are doing it because that's their life, you know? I mean,
mm-hmm.
your mother does it because that was her life. That's what
it
we do.
It became her life. Absolutely.
Right.
It became
but we
her
look
life.
Back at our grandmothers. How did they do it? They did it because
mm-hmm.
they did it, you
mm-hmm.
know? And now we look at it as a billable expense, you know?
Well, and, you know, from my perspective, I don't have a problem with that. When my mother was caring for my dad, there were very few services for seniors,
yes.
and
yes.
there were zero services for caregivers because
right.
we didn't even have the word yet. So she was isolated and lonesome and managing this thing all by
mm-hmm.
herself on a Kansas farm that was six miles northwest of a town of 14,000 people. So her strategy, her way of managing her stress was to just disengage her emotional monitor and go to her computer and write letters to me. You know, I wish there had been services for her, but
mm-hmm.
there weren't.
Right,
but
because it, you know, with everybody moving away, these, you know, like I said in the
yes.
beginning of the show,
yes.
with people so
yes.
dislodged, there aren't those, you know, have your neighbor come over, or have her sister down the street, or have her cousin over on the other side, you know, those family members just aren't available.
Well, and in my mother's case, as you read in the book, she was a New Age thinker and became a New Age thinker in the early 1960s. And she was living in this incredibly conservative farming community where women were supposed to help with the farm work. You know, our nearest neighbor was a quarter mile away. And so the women that she knew through all the 4-H groups and the, you know, the little country school and the school board and all of that, they were very conservative. And so her ideas of reading, I remember she read Think and Grow Rich, you know, on this dairy farm. And it's like, I think I was 9 years old or 10 years old. And even I thought, you know, I don't think you can think your way out of being poor on this farm. But she was not happy with her physical life. She did not enjoy her physical life. And so in order for her to survive, she became a devotee of self-help books. So she was always reading something that would help her find her own peace and happiness from within. Mm-hmm. And so she did not have, you know, she did not have a lot of neighbors or friends around. And I didn't either, for that matter. I only had one other girl in my class from the first grade through the seventh grade before I went into school in town. And so I think, you know, Mom and I developed a really, really close relationship because there just weren't any other options. And she was a very special woman. But by writing letters, she felt it was a safe way for her to express her emotions without people thinking she was a rotten human being or someone who was kind of scary, because there are a lot of negative emotions that come with caring for a husband who does not very closely resemble a person that you've been married to for over 50 years.
I think, and I always speak to that as the darkness of life, because mm-hmm. it's a time when you see all of these things that come out in you, and you're saying, mm-hmm. I'll keep shoving them down, but I really don't like what he's doing, or, oh, if I have to clean that up again, or, mm-hmm. oh, my gosh, mm-hmm. can he just go to bed, or maybe I can give him three of these pills instead of one, you know? Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. so many people think of these things because they just feel the great weight of the world. And mm-hmm. I think sometimes when you have books or you have letters or you have life or you have the, and now everybody has the internet, it's all about bringing that light and saying, you can go into mm-hmm. the light and live your life for a little while, mm-hmm. even though mm-hmm. you have to go back to the darkness of the life to live that for the rest of the day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And finding a way to connect with that light is really important. People who read my book tell me that Madeline gives them permission to be human, that right. she said in her letters things that they had not had the nerve, that they had all thought, but they did not have the nerve to say out loud.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's important because sometimes when you go to these groups and stuff, you feel mm-hmm. like you have to be like the peeps, I call them. All the people around you got to talk and walk the same way, because if you talk out of sync, mm-hmm. it's mm-hmm. not really mm-hmm. the best place, because then you feel mm-hmm. ostracized or looked at. Sometimes
mm-hmm.
it's
or judged.
Even,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, and sometimes it's easier to put it into a letter to be able, and you don't have any barriers. You have no judgments. You have no boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
You can
mm-hmm.
say what you
mm-hmm.
feel. And it, mm-hmm. I think she was lucky to be able to mail those to you, but I think also a therapy could be to write the letters and even put them in a box if you have to, if you have no one to send them to.
Yeah, I think that sometimes she was writing a letter to me. I mean, a typical letter from her might be 6 to 10 pages. It was typed single space, printed on both sides of the page. Mm-hmm. So there was, there was always a lot of information about my brothers and their wives and, you know, the nieces and nephews and the weather and, you know, things that were going on in her life. But each letter to me was sort of like the old episode television series of MASH, you know?
Mm-hmm.
There was always something that made me laugh, something that made me cry, something that made me believe it was possible to find joy and hope, even in the midst of loss and tragedy. And I think sometimes when she was writing these letters, especially the hard parts, that it wasn't really about writing a letter to me and informing me. I think it was more journaling. I think she was just releasing everything that was going on in her heart and her mind. And I told her, I think it was a couple of years after she started writing, I said, you know, Mom, I save your letters. And I think she was pretty amazed and honored by that. And about 5 years into it, she said, I wish I had been keeping a journal all of these years. I think that it would be interesting to see how I have grown mentally and spiritually, and I think that my experiences could help other people who are in a similar situation. And when she wrote that, I felt like she was giving me permission to do whatever I wanted to do with her letters.
Mm-hmm. And I, think
I don't know
so
whether
too.
She was, but I took it that way.
Right. But I think so, too, when you're able to do that, you can actually look back and say, I still can find my thread through this. And I haven't lost myself in that caregiving.
Yes.
A lot of time people feel that they're losing their identity because it's all about the other person. But sometimes there is an identity and there is that part of you that's still there that can still think or that can still say things like, when we talk about, you know, having your light of your day, you know, sometimes on my website we'll say, what was your up and your down today? You know, my up was, did you see the clouds today? I mean, I'm a crazy cloud person. I must have thousands of pictures of clouds because I just see the clouds all the time, you know, and then I'll go back in them and I'll say, did you see that face? Did you see that dog? You know, so I look in the clouds, you know. But then also the pit of the day could be, my gosh, you know, my husband isn't feeling well and he's always in pain and I wish I knew what to do, but I can't fix it and I don't know what to do, so I can just be there. That's all you can do. And I think that is, you know, to be able to say there are these ups and downs all the time. Sometimes people get so caught up in the you know, the life of perfection. You know, when you come off of the 40s and 50s and you go into the 60s, you know, everything is supposed to be perfect. You know, you saved your money for this perfect vacation. You saved your money for this perfect cabin. And all of a sudden, you know, you feel like the 2x4 is coming down the road, you know?
Boy, isn't that the truth.
Yeah, and I think you know, you can say all kinds of accolades and all kinds of words you want around it, but it will still feel the same. It's not great, you know?
Well, I think I speak at a lot of conferences. The way this came about is that after I edited Mom's letters into the book, it took me about 3 years to go through. I just retyped anything that made me laugh or made me cry, and I had a huge manuscript. So I cut that by about 50%, and then I cut it again by about 40%. So I ended up with the essence of it. And as I went through it, I realized that there were four emotions that she experienced over and over and over again. And I believe that this is universal with all caregivers, and that is anger, guilt, depression, and grief. Mm-hmm. And when you look at it, there the number of people, situations, and events that can make a caregiver upset are practically limitless, you know? You start with the disease or the condition, and then you look at your care receiver and their behavior and the things that they can do to make you crazy. And then you have family members and friends who don't show up, you know, unless it's to criticize
right.
or or condemn. And then and then you have the medical community, insurance companies, VA offices. I mean, you just go on and on and on and on. And they have so many reasons to get upset. And I think it really helps to understand that anger is a normal and predictable response to circumstances over which we have little or no control. So if you can understand that and accept that, that you're going to, you know, unless you've just recently ascended, you are going to get angry as a caregiver. What normally happens is people get angry, they lose their temper, they say something that they wish they hadn't, and then they feel guilty. And I really think that guilt is probably the most overused emotion that most caregivers experience. Would you agree with that?
Oh, definitely. And also, too, let's go back on anger for 1 second, because many stages of pre-dementia or Alzheimer's can start out as anger, you know, and we look at it and we say, well, they, you know, they finished their job and they retired and now they've been an angry, you know what, for the past 10 years, and then now they're sick and they have dementia and Alzheimer's, when really that was a preempt of it. And, you know, even myself, you know, I talk about, sometimes I've mentioned it on the radio, is that when people start having trouble with their cholesterol, they start having trouble with their heart, the heart is suppressed emotions and the liver is really anger, you know. So if you start having trouble with all these things in your 60s and 70s, you look at it and you say, and now it's traveling to the brain, you know, and then it's just, it seems like this circle that we don't recognize sometimes. And we wish we had, so then that turns into a whole lot of guilt. Well, why didn't I get the medication in the beginning? Or why didn't I notice it in the beginning? We all know those those people, you know. And it's a pretty tough place to be, I think. And a lot of times, just as you've said, you know, some of the relatives come in and they want to help and they don't want to help. But, boy, when dementia and Alzheimer's comes in, and it's like you're hard-pressed to find anybody to come to help you.
That's true. Because that that disease changes people's personalities. It makes their behavior very difficult to understand. They might ask you the same questions 50 times in the course of 5 minutes. And it's I believe that Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia are the worst diseases in terms of caring for people. Now, my dad had some stroke-related dementia. We had never heard the term at the time, and we didn't quite understand it. But he certainly did experience some behavior that was different from what he would have done before the stroke. So you take this anger, and I think it's really important, Dr. Jeanette, for people to find a way to release it, whether that is writing in a journal, writing letters. I believe that exercise is a really great way to help get rid of some of it. Deep breathing, getting out in nature, listening to music, doing something that, you know, helps bring down that stress level is really important. I had a speaking engagement for an Alzheimer's conference in Iowa several years ago, and a woman came up to me afterward and she said, well, I've got an anger management program and it requires 2 dozen eggs a day. And I said, well, tell me about that. That sounds very interesting.
Well, she's growing the mat.
It's exactly right. She lived on an egg farm, and every morning she would go out and she would collect the eggs to sell, and then she would set 2 dozen aside for herself. And then in the afternoon at 3:56, when the train would come by their farm, she would go out and she'd take her basket of eggs, and she would throw the eggs at the train. She said if it was a short train, she would throw them really, really fast. If it was a long train, she would take aim and throw them at the logos. And I've always thought that was such a funny story. And then, you know, you, then I thought about it from the perspective of the engineer, and I thought, he must think that lady really hates trains, you know.
Right. And or maybe she was throwing at it because she wishes she was on the train.
Yeah, maybe so.
It didn't stop for her, so she was so mad it didn't stop to take her with him. Right?
That's great. I had never thought of that perspective, but, mm-hmm. You know, I sometimes tell people, you know, some days you're the egg lady and you're throwing the eggs, and some days you're the train, you know, some days you catch somebody else's wrath and it has absolutely nothing to do with you, but you are there and you become an easy target for someone else's anger. So, you know, whether we are the ones that are getting angry or we are the ones that are catching somebody else's anger, it kind of helps to understand that that could be the issue.
And also, too, let's talk a little bit about taking care of people that maybe you have not had such a good history with. I had spoken with a woman the other day, and she said that her mother now has dementia. She's taking care of her, and she's just really sick of doing it, and she's just like, she's just very angry with the whole thing. And her mother would do something, and the girl would go off. The girl is in her 40s, and she would go off, and she would say, gosh, you know, why does my mother do something like that? Doesn't she know that I've never liked that in the first place? Or, in other words, she was still playing the child and the mother role instead of the adult and the elder role. And, you know, I had spoken to her and I said, sometimes, you know, our first phase of talking, I said, sometimes can you look at it as her perspective is that it really, she doesn't know what she's doing and it has nothing to do with you, and, you know, and can you separate that? And then she kind of went off on her own little tirade for a few weeks or months about that. And then she came back and then and she was still going on. I says, maybe if you take the word, you're not caring for your mother, you're caring for an elder person. Take the word mother out of it and just take it for the gift it is that you're just caring for someone else. And she said, okay, I'll try that. And I think that was like the first time she had said, you know, okay, I think I can do this. If I just get up and look at it as this is an elder woman who is in need of my care. And if I was an elder woman who needed care, I would hope someone else would do it too, instead of attaching the word mother to it all the time. You know,
oh, that's a really interesting thought. Yeah, I like that.
Yeah, because I think sometimes we look at them, and, you know, and all of that history comes up in our head, and it's sort of like shut that TV off in your head, you know, and some people can't. But, you know, even when people have dementia and Alzheimer's, we look at them, or even when people are sick, we look at them, and their physical attributes change so drastically, you almost can't recognize them. So in a way, that in itself, if we look at it, we could say that in itself is a gift. They're saying to me, I don't have to play the tape. They don't look like the mother that, you know, was whatever many years ago. They look differently now. So I can change the name on this physical being, you know. So I guess maybe it does take a little work, but I think it may help some people. And it really helped her where she said, you know, when I get up in the morning, it's not my mother. It's a woman that's asking me to help her eat.
Wow.
And change that.
That's great. I have spoken with many, many professional caregivers, and they all say that it is so much easier to take care of someone that they have not known, you know, or of a patient than it is to take care of their own parents. And I have always thought that it probably has to do with the fact that
history.
When you're caring for a parent, you're grieving the loss of who that person used to be. And that comes from a perspective of having a good relationship or, you know, loving who that person used to be. That isn't always the case.
Because don't forget, you always have the ones, too, who did not have loving relationships in their lives.
Right.
And you look at that and you say, you know, or the ones that are still waiting for to hear from their parents mm-hmm. that they're loved, that they're cared mm-hmm. for, that they were mm-hmm. worthy or whatever it might be, or, mm-hmm. you know, whatever it is. And you feel like you're on a vicious cycle there of, you know, my mother, her memory is going to go and I wish she would hurry up and tell me she loves me or whatever, you know, those kind of ideas.
Right.
And that's a tough place.
It is a tough place. And for people who have not had a good relationship with their parents, I recommend buying the book, Doing the Right Thing, Caring for Your Elderly Parents, Even If They Did Not Take Care of You. And it's by Dr. Roberta Satow, S-A-T-O-W. And this book is really, really good. I read it and I just loved it, and I had great parents, but it was still very beneficial to me because it helps you understand how to set boundaries, how to take care of yourself while you're doing what you think is absolutely necessary or what you feel is your obligation to take care of an older parent. But I think it also could apply to a husband or a child or to a friend, anyone. The main thing is learning how to set boundaries and take care of yourself. And I think that's probably the most important thing you can do for yourself as a caregiver.
And also, too, the concept that you are required by some, I think, you know, it's not one of the Ten Commandments that you have to take care of your family members, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think many people, when they are born, they believe that they have to do that when the time comes. Oh, you have to because they did this, and this, and this mm-hmm. for you. And that's not really necessarily the truth, you know? Parents, I think we come into the world sometimes with an idea that, you know, it's something that we have to latch on to, and you have to take care of them, and then you love them, and everything works out, and everything is great. Many families have that. Many families don't. And
right.
the ones that
right.
don't, you know, you have to realize that your parents, they may have raised it to your 18, and, you know, if you're 80, that's only 18 years out of your life. You took care of yourself the rest of the time. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So it's different to say that you know, you really need that to do that for that other person. I know for myself, I don't do funerals. I went to one funeral in my life, one, and it was my godmother, and she died very quickly. And she had breast and brain cancer. And I remember going to the funeral in the church, and I was wailing like nobody's business. I'm telling you, they had to take me out of the church. I don't know where it came from. I don't know what happened. Then I went to the cemetery. Same thing. I was wailing like crazy. And my father was making excuses. He said, oh, she didn't know and it was her godmother, blah, blah, blah. But really what it was is that I had taken on I'm totally an energetic person, and I had taken on the woman's energy, you know. So it was an energetic thing, a spiritually
wow.
kind of thing that
mm-hmm.
happened at the funeral. It was
mm-hmm.
like, oh, my gosh. I had not realized it at that time. But anyway, from that day, I just don't do funerals. And I think that's our right as people to say, we don't have to do some of these things that
mm-hmm.
in the past people may have said we had to do.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We're not a bad person because we don't do them, you know. And it's not, you're doing the best you can all the way around the circle. And to let go of some of that guilt. I think a lot of people, when they have to be called on to be a caregiver, and they say, I can't, or it's not in my wheelhouse, or I will help you support you some other way, but I just can't do that, and to be
mm-hmm.
okay with that.
I'd like to talk about guilt, because I think this is one of the most difficult emotions that caregivers have to deal with. And if we look in the dictionary defines guilt as a sense of having done something wrong or having failed in an obligation. And I think sometimes that is true, but I think that more often than not, we probably experience guilt because of the way we feel towards someone.
Mm-hmm.
And it's you know, you get angry with your care receiver, and then you feel guilty for being angry with them because, after all, they're sick, they're helpless, they can't, you know, it's not their fault that they're in this situation, and you should be able to stay loving and kind and supportive and all
right.
of this. So then you feel like you're a bad person, and you take on this feeling of guilt as if there's something that you should be ashamed of, that this is a personal failing on your part. And for anyone who has ever been controlled by what I call a guilt tripper, they're very, very good at manipulating you and making you feel like you're a lousy human being. And so you end up doing things that you don't want to do because you don't want to feel guilty. And I was a card-carrying codependent for many, many years because I was married to a raging mm-hmm. alcoholic for 19 years. Mm-hmm. And I finally reached the point that I simply could not take it one more day. And I made an appointment with a counselor, and I went in and sat down. And I said, "So how long do we have?" And she said, "We have 50 minutes. And I said, "Okay." And she said, "What do you want to accomplish?" And I said, "You know, I want to figure out in this session how I can get a divorce and make it okay for my soon-to-be ex-husband and my three teenage children." And she said, "Okay." So, you know, I took a deep breath, and for the next 45 minutes, I told her how everybody was feeling, how this was going to affect everyone, you know, how the kids were acting, how my ex-husband was reacting and all of this. And then I looked at my watch and I said, "Oh, wow, we're about out of time." And she said, "Yes, we are." And she said, "I'm just going to give you one piece of advice." And I said, "What's that?" And she said, "Get in your own shoes and stay in them."
Mm-hmm.
And I said, "I don't think I understand." And she said, "Obviously you don't understand." She said, "You are so wrapped up in everybody else's feelings and their thoughts and needs that you have no idea what you are feeling or needing." And she said, "You need to get in your own shoes, and you need to identify what you need." And I was like, "Wow, can I do that? I mean, you know, I thought that thinking about myself was really selfish, and if I did think about my own needs or feelings, that made me a bad person." And I said, "You know, my husband is going to get so angry." And she said, "So let him." She said, "His feelings are his, and they are not your responsibility. You are responsible for your own feelings, not for his. And so stop letting his anger control you." And it was like, whoa, you know, that was kind of the beginning of a new life for me. And so, you know, when I talk to caregivers, there was one man who said that he felt so guilty because he hated going to see his mother. You know, he would get up every morning and he would dread the fact that he was going to go see her later in the day. And as the day progressed, he would just feel worse and worse because he hated going to see her. He would go every day at 4 o'clock because he knew at 5 o'clock someone would come in and get her and take her to dinner, and then he could escape. And I said, "Okay, so let's look at this from a different perspective. How many of you in the room would feel, if you were 90 years old, you could no longer communicate, you did not recognize your child, you could not carry on a conversation, how many of you would feel that you were the luckiest person in the world if your son still came to see you every single day at 4 o'clock?" And of course, everybody raised their hand. And I said, "You know, so don't take on guilt because you don't want to go see her. Instead, congratulate yourself for doing the right thing and for being a good son." And then I encourage people to change their emotional vocabulary, because guilt is a sense of really doing something wrong. And that makes you, if you feel guilty, you feel like you are a bad person, like you have let somebody else down, that you have failed in some way.
Right.
And then instead of taking on guilt, I'd like for you to think in terms of regret. So you could say like, okay, I regret that I sometimes run out of energy and I cannot do all of the things my parents need for me to do. I regret that I sometimes resent the amount of money it takes to take care of them. I regret that I can't keep all of the promises made in the past. I regret that I don't enjoy our time together. I regret that our relationship has changed. I regret that I can't go back and, fix things that have happened in the past. I regret that, you know, I can't make them stronger or healthier or happier. I regret that their life is the way this is, but, I regret a lot of things, but I don't do guilt anymore.
Right.
And that can really, really shift things. So, you know, instead of feeling guilty, like if you say, I cannot give up my job and come home and take care of you, you can say, I regret that I'm not in a position to do this, that I have a job, I have a family, I have other things that I need to do. But don't take on that guilt. You can regret it, but not feel guilty for it.
And then I think so, too, there may be some cracks in that, because also, too, as those regrets, you start to realize them and feel them,
mm-hmm.
you also can start to say, but I regret that I, something, and then you could say, but when I do come to see her, she is happy, or when I do come to see her, I bring her a flower, or when I do come to see her, she's doing better, or when I do come to see her, I see that her time is coming closer. See, so it doesn't always have to be so positive that everything's getting better. It can be a positive that her time is ending, you know?
Yes.
So
yes.
It can go either way there. Those are not always negative thoughts, but those are also the thoughts that you can still see and find the hope or the faith or the belief on that other side, or that what I always say to people, find a light every day. Take your cell phone, find a light every day. If it's the light shining in on your wall, take a picture of it. You found light today. So find light every day, no matter what the regret is or the sadness or the guilt or the anger, and find one light. You know, every day. Even if you have zero light in your day, turn on a lamp and take a picture of the lamp, because, you know, you will start to understand, you know, that those things are always there, you know. The sun comes up, the clouds are there, the sun shining through the window is there, you know. Sometimes when someone's not feeling well, what do? We push their chair into the sunlight, because we know light. Light is the essence of that. Light is what shifts us. Light is what changes us, you know. How many times do we say when people are sick, put them outside, you know. We used to say that, but anyway, put them outside, you know. And I think so as you shift from guilt and then use the word regret, then you'll start finding those light cracks, you know, and eventually it will shift it, I think. So it really brings you around full circle, so that you don't feel like you're stuck in a paradigm also.
And one thing that you mentioned earlier is we're keeping people alive longer and longer and longer. And I think the medical community and each of us need to accept the fact that none of us are ever going to get out of this life alive. And I don't know if you've read Dr. Atul Gawande's book, Being Mortal. It's a fabulous book. The first half of it talks about making choices about where and how we want to live in this last chapter of our lives. And then the second half is about choosing how we want to control our death. And it's just such a beautiful book. And I think we, you know, people in the medical community are trained to defeat disease. They are mm-hmm. trained to fight illness. They are trained to extend life. And that, in my opinion, is not always the best possible course of action.
Right. But when patients come in, here's their comment, they will say, I have arthritis. I know this one woman, I have arthritis in my hands, does all the extreme things. And at the last visit, the doctor says, well, where are we really going with all this treatment? She says, but I don't want to have arthritis like my father. You know, mm-hmm. so in other words, she had to heal that part with her father. She didn't have to heal mm-hmm. her arthritis. So I think mm-hmm. the idea that we're really, what doctors are really doing, they're really kind of stuck up. Healthcare is going to come to an implosion, because they're trying to fix and hold things back in people. Yet people have to be responsible for that. But also, too, we have to accept that we can't be always fighting and to hold things off, you know what I mean? Inevitables.
Mm-hmm. We're not immortal.
I run all of those things, and you go into the doctor and he'll say, well, what really here is the goal? And you say, well, I want to be well. I mean, people come to me as a naturopath, they always say, mm-hmm. the biggest thing is I have to be healthy and wellness. And I'm going, what does that mean to you? Well, mm-hmm. here's my picture from when I was 40. I need that again. It's like, good luck with that, and they want anti this, they want anti-age, antibiotics, uh-huh. antiviral. Uh-huh. So you're going to go out there and anti everything in the world,
mm-hmm.
and then you're going to be whole and well. And, I've always said to people on the show is that our spirit and our soul is a continuum. This lifetime mm-hmm. is just a wardrobe change. So just enjoy mm-hmm. the ride.
And
I think if you can just enjoy the ride and say it has a beginning, it has an end, okay, good,
mm-hmm.
how can we easily go through it instead of always bombarding ourselves with, as you said, the shoulds, would, could, the guilt, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. and everything else, and just ease through it, just try to ease through it as much as you can.
My mother would have loved you so much.
Those are the thoughts we think.
Well, she thought along those lines, and she was really quite ahead of her time, I think, and out of place. But this controlling her thinking and her attitude, and mm-hmm. Tapping into her spiritual center
right.
was the key to her survival, because her body was shot.
Right.
She was losing her vision because of macular degeneration. Her back was hunched with osteoporosis. She had congestive heart failure, restless leg syndrome, and severe hearing loss. So you wouldn't expect her to be somebody else's caregiver with
right.
all of those things going on. And she did it with her mind,
right.
because she certainly could not have done it with her body alone.
That's important.
Mm-hmm, it's very, very important. And she developed what she called an attitude of creative indifference. In the
mm-hmm.
beginning, she called it a detached attitude. And when I asked her what that meant, she said, what it means is that she detached herself emotionally from her physical
right.
surroundings. She was able to find her own peace and happiness from within. And by doing that, she was able to not allow herself to become emotionally ravaged by dad's disease or the progression of events. And then she eventually, this evolved into what she called an attitude of creative indifference. And I asked her what the difference was one time. She said, oh, it's no difference. It's the same thing. She just said, I just think detached sounds a little cold. But
mm-hmm.
As I went through her letters, then I realized that she did three things every time she came up against something that really upset her. And the first thing was to become aware of it. And she would write it down. She would write what was up, she would write about what was upsetting her, and she would describe all of the contributing factors. And then the second step was acceptance. And I believe that this is the most difficult thing that all caregivers have to do, and probably right. all human beings, you know, is that you look at a situation and you realize there are a lot of complicating and contributing factors that make this difficult. And mm-hmm. you just accept that there are some things that you are not going to be able to change or fix, and that there are some outcomes that are not going to be what you wish they could be. And then the third step is to take action. And with there are two parts to this. You look at a problem and you say, okay, do I have any influence, power, or control over this situation? And if it is a problem that has a solution, then you make a plan, you execute the plan, and you fix the problem. More often than not, when you're dealing with someone who is elderly, disabled, or suffering with a progressive and degenerative disease, there are problems that you cannot fix. And mm-hmm. so you look at that and you say, okay, what do I do in this situation? Do I obsess over it? Do I let it wake me up at 3:00 in the morning? Or do I just detach myself from it? Do I release it? Do I let it go? And just understand that this is one of those things that's beyond your control. So that is the foundation of my workshops my caregiver help website is helping people develop an attitude of creative indifference toward anger, guilt, depression, and grief, and kind of take them through these three steps with each one of these emotions, and to be able to look at, you know, what is the situation, what are the things that you have to accept, and then what can you do about it, and either fix it or let it go.
And also to be sure that you recognize that other person that you're giving care to also mm-hmm. has similar path that they're on, that they're feeling guilt and all of these other things, and they're not wanting where they know their end might be coming, or they don't want to live mm-hmm. like they're mm-hmm. living, and mm-hmm. they may have given up everything. You know, we always look at it from our side, but we have to look at it from their side too. And I think mm-hmm. compassion and empathy are huge. But so when compassion, empathy for the person you're taking care of, but also compassion, empathy comes from the person you are caring for if you just allow it. Sometimes the caregiver can get so shut down they don't notice the little light things that are actually coming from the person you're caring for. Mm-hmm. You know, the person you're caring for, they may spill a whole tray of food on the floor, but then all of a sudden they'll start laughing. And mm-hmm. what it was supposed to meant was, just laugh. It'll be okay. We clean it up. So what?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
and be able to be a little bit light sometimes, you know,
mm-hmm.
to take
mm-hmm.
those little things. And I think those are really so important to look at. It's not an easy task to be a caregiver. It's not an easy task to take care of anyone. And
no.
it's also not an easy task to be a patient, because let me tell you, both sides are a pretty tough venture, you know.
That's
so,
the truth.
You know, I can totally understand when someone's totally PO'd and they would like to just take everything in their room and throw it against the wall
mm-hmm,
because they
mm-hmm.
feel like they can't talk after they had a stroke, or they feel like
mm-hmm.
they can't this, that, or the other, you know.
Mm-hmm,
I can
mm-hmm,
remember
mm-hmm.
In closing, we have just a few more minutes, but I was in a clinic one time at my school, and I was sitting next to a woman. And she had just had a stroke, and she couldn't talk. She was trying to get the words out. And the other six people in the room were all males, and they were her husband and her son and the other interns that were in the room at the
mm-hmm.
same time. And I was sitting next to her, and I was just patiently looking at her and paying attention to what she was trying to say. I wasn't getting wrapped up into all of it. And I just reached over and set my hand on her back. And man, you would have thought I'd commit the cardinal sin because I was going to get kicked out of school because they said that, don't I ever take her pain away? And I'm thinking, wow, how powerful must you think I am that I can take her pain away, you know? And I had to look at it like that because truly, you know, we have to realize and understand that they're human beings. They're not just someone that you work with or on, you know.
That is such a strange response.
Yeah, wasn't it? And yeah, and I can remember just doing that. And you know, the woman, you know, after she would just, and she just kind of, I could feel her tension kind of ease. Mm-hmm. And then her words would start to come easier. In other words, her frustration was mounting upward just to feel comforted in the world, I think, is a lot what caregivers are giving. And what mm-hmm. people as patients are looking for is just tell me I'm comforted in the world I'm in. I've got to know that. I've got to feel that. Just tell me it will be okay. And sometimes that's all they're looking for is that hand or that eye contact. So that guilt trip that you're putting out there is sometimes the guilt that's coming in your head is not really always what they think or they feel. It's your feelings and your road trip that you're on, you know. Sometimes just put your hand out and that guilt dissolves. So a lot of times, you know, those tapes that we play in our head, you know, just VCRs are out of stock, you know. Put it away, you know, get away from it. Stop doing it. That's old.
That's for sure.
Yeah, that's like that's old stuff. You don't need it anymore. And just to be in the present, you know.
That's
and
great.
I think it's, you know, it's just interesting the way the world works these days and how this has all been playing out. So, Elaine, in closing, can you share just more information about yourself? And we'll definitely have you back on because we can't even stop talking. There's a lot of other things we didn't even get to, so it would be great.
Oh, thank you so much. I would encourage people to go to my website. It is caregiverhelp.com. It's all free. It's commercial free. I just developed it for people like my mother who might need a little bit of emotional support to get through a difficult day or a sleepless night. So I have almost 5 hours of videos on there. I have hundreds of blogs and articles, links to other websites that I think are helpful. And I would just like to invite you to go there if you're needing a little help dealing with the emotional stress of caregiving. My book, Letters from Madeline, Chronicles of a Caregiver, is the second edition, brand new, was just released in May, and it is available in bookstores and on Amazon. So, and I love to speak at conferences and all sorts of different organizations, so you can contact me through my website. So, Dr. Jeanette, thank you so much. This has just been a delight. You've brought up some things that I have never thought of before, and it was a very stimulating and fun conversation.
Absolutely, Elaine. Thank you so much for joining us. It was a real pleasure to have you because I think a lot of people are so afraid to let that inner part of themselves shine out. And I think sometimes when we bring it out, that darkness out into the light, it can dissolve. It's sort of like, you know, airing your house out. Open up the windows and just let all that stuff go, you know. And I think that's what we really need to be doing these days. You know, do that on a daily basis. Whatever's in there, hey, I go around and light candles when my husband goes to work, you know. It's like, I got to clear this energy. So, you know, do whatever you can. Whatever you got to do, you do.
I love it. So I'm going to look for the light today.
I'm telling you, look for that light wherever it is. And you have to click it on your phone so that you can remember it. The point is that because sometimes we are so fleeting. We say, oh, yeah, I saw it. And we're still going on in our old path. But if we can see it and say, I saw it and here it is, then it kind of sticks with us, you know, like a habit.
Great idea.
Yeah, well, thank you, Elaine, so much for joining us, and we hope to have you on our show again.
Thank you. I would be honored.
Thank you. If you'd like to find out more about Elaine Sanchez, again, her book is Letters from Madeline, Chronicles of a Caregiver. Please do check on the bottom of today's show page for that direct link to her website. And if you are a caregiver, if you're giving care, if you're receiving care, and you need someone or something to just hold on to say, you know, this has just not been my great day, please do check out Elaine's website. And thank you so much for joining us today. It was such a pleasure. This is Dr. Jeanette Gallagher, and until tomorrow, have a great day.
Today we discussed many life-changing concepts. Who do you turn to, and how do you know what is best when faced with a health crisis? Dr. Jeanette is a patient advocate. She listens to the patient, the doctors, and the family, clarifies the health issues and concerns, then helps the patient make the best choices going forward. If you would like help implementing change into your life and health, we can talk and see where you are stuck and how to improve the quality of your life. Check the link on the bottom of today's show page or visit drjeanettegallagher.com to schedule a phone appointment today.